Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. My name is Kurt Wilson. I'm the Armchair Survivalist, and today is December the 15th in the year 2019. Welcome to the show. Obviously, if you're listening to me, then you have at least one way to listen to me. If you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, then you'll be able to look at, if you scroll down at armchairsurvivalist.com, you'll see all the different ways you can listen to me. I have over 23 ways now, all kinds of different podcast platforms, on YouTube, Global Star 3 satellite. You can go to my chat room, armchairsurvivalist.com/chat.html. There's a link there. Any page you go to, there'll be a link to the what I call the Bulletin Board and Listening Center. If you just go to the chat page, you can listen. There's no chat that's going to be available except for admins, moderators, or if I want to tell somebody news what's going on or what have you. That's all that's for. It's moderators only. So that's how you can listen. There's all kinds of different ways. Even you can call up and listen on your phone. Now, if you call this number and you get some weird recording, just dial again. And it's not toll-free, so it's on your dime. 641-741-0371. That's 641-741-0371. On the left-hand side of any of the pages at armchairsurvivalist.com, you'll see home, chat room, show notes, Survival Enterprises, my store. And then you'll see the little white nipper dog listening to the RCA Victor gramophone. You click on that, and that's the past shows that I've done for the current year. And you can click on any of those, download any of those. Now, if you just missed the show, and the show usually is on Sunday, 2 to 4 Pacific time. And if you just missed the show, well, there's a link you can click on. It says, listen 24 hours a day to the most recent show of the Armchair Survivalist. Click here. Do so, and wow, look, you got the most recent show. Your Android phone and the Apple phone, your phone, cell phones won't, you can't listen. If you go to the website on your cell phone, you're not going to be able to listen to the show as it comes out because it's a flash program, and cell phones don't have flash programs. I use Chatango in the chat room, as the chat room, and I understand that Chatango has an app for Android. I don't know. I haven't tried it yet, but maybe it'll work and you can use that. Otherwise, there's all kinds of different ways to listen. We even had some guys, and I thought this was cool. They were in a hunting camp way up in the mountains, and they wanted to listen to my show, and they didn't know how to work their new cell phone. I helped them figure it out, and they were able to listen to me. So right now, it's me and Felix the Cat in my studio. Well, I'll give you some things of what's going on with the business. We still have some items that we're closing out, and the food tabs, heirloom seeds, pepper seeds. And then we have, now we're just getting them in now because the Christmas season shipping is going crazy. We're going to be carrying a line of cold steel knives and walking sticks and canes. Now, why am I carrying these canes? Yeah, there's a bunch of us old farts out there that need canes. These aren't normal canes, even though the TSA thinks they are, the Department of Homeland Security thinks they are, and any of the Antifa thugs that want to screw with you while you're walking down the street will think they're normal canes also until you whack them in the head with them. This is cold steel. Cold steel doesn't screw around. These are usually 17 layers of polypropylene or even Kevlar. These are canes, all right. They're also weapons. Now, we got them in the store. I'm not going to ship these things. It's too difficult to ship them. So you'll have to come to our store in Hayden, Idaho. Yeah, so we're going to have a bunch of that stuff. Now, if you go to my store in Hayden, Idaho, we have our normal stuff we sell. And then we have all the oddball stuff we have. We're downsizing our house. So I'm bringing so much stuff to the store to sell, just to get rid of. Everything from a pressure cooker oven, countertop oven, to 12 floodlights, to spawn toys, to used cell phones. I got so much, and clothes. I got lined pants. I got stuff here. I got stuff. So feel free to come to the store in Hayden, Idaho. Now, December 10th was my birthday, and it was very noteworthy because Square, which we've been using as credit card processing, updated their terms of service on my birthday and then canceled us in the middle of a transaction. This is the fourth time in 2 years that a credit card processing company has canceled our account with no warning and no stated reason. You might or might not know some of our history, but for the past 25 years, Survival Enterprises has been under attack. IRS, Franchise Tax Board, FBI, ATF, EPA, OSHA, I could go on. And when the government failed everything to take us down, now the deep state's using liberal corporations to destroy us. And this is not just us. There are thousands and thousands of conservative businesses throughout the United States that are being screwed with. This is no ifs, ands, or buts, the deep state. We've been in business over 35 years. We've had one chargeback in 5 years, and we have never had a customer's credit card compromised. We're not selling anything illegal, and we're not doing anything illegal, and we have no recourse. Square doesn't allow you recourse. You know what Square is. You've seen these people with the cell phone, and they got this little square that plugs in the top, and they can swipe a credit card. Well, that's what we've been using because it's very simple, except Square is owned by Twitter, and as we all know, Twitter is silencing everything that has to do with conservatism. This isn't new. This stuff by Square, well, it could be political. It could be locational, because in some of our research, we discovered that they're shutting down businesses in the Dakotas and Idaho, and I don't know why. It could be because we sell nutritional products. It could be because I have a big mouth and I get on the air and I tell millions of people weekly what's going on. But here's a little clip on the whole thing.
A local attorney is joining a chorus of complaints about the high-tech credit card processor Square. You probably use it at a festival or at a small business.
This is Square, and it turns any smartphone into a credit card payment machine. A company document says in a year's time they processed $32 billion worth of transactions. A local attorney headquartered here thought his business would be a perfect fit. But now he says Square has him running in circles.
But this Square just seems so easy, and it's not.
Criminal defense attorney George Plumity signed up for Square as a quick way to swipe clients' cards, even from the jail. Assistant Maury James did the swiping.
That they make you believe you run your first transaction and it'll be in your bank account tomorrow.
But after running $2,500 in legal fees for a criminal suspect, Square squawked.
They've taken my money and they're holding it for 90 days. For what reason? What reason could you possibly think of other than that company's earning interest on my money?
In an email, Square called the charges high-risk activity. They closed the account and are holding the money for 90 days. Paragraph 42 of the user agreement says they have the right to cancel the business owner for any reason or no reason at any time.
You can't discuss it, and they say, and this decision is final.
Plumity's is not alone. While Square has an A-plus BBB rating, we also found more than 1,200 complaints and two class action lawsuits from other lawyers denied service.
I've been a lawyer for 25 years, never had anything like this happen.
All new at 10, a small business owner says he may have to shut down because his credit card processing company is holding thousands of his dollars.
Scott Newberry owns the fireplace installation and repair company called A Safe Home. He's been in business 4 years and accepting credit cards through the Square for two.
It's just a convenience to help our customers.
Newberry has used it a lot.
I'd say probably at least 100,000 in 2 years, maybe more.
He's had no complaints. Then last month, he tried to buy parts and his card was declined. He checked his account.
It said pending, 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 pending. I quit adding it up after 7,000. I'm like, well, no wonder I don't have any money. Square has my money.
Square told Newberry they were holding his money because of a chargeback and his large volume of transactions. Newberry sent them his bank records, but they requested more.
It'll take 30 to 90 days before you get your money, but keep using Square.
As for the company's 3% fee per transaction,
it shows they took their money and they kept mine.
What is this doing to your business?
I told Square, I said, look, I can't buy my fireplaces. This is going to shut me down.
Consumer Justice found more than 1,600 similar complaints about Square through the Better Business Bureau. We talked to another small business owner in Santa Barbara, California, who said Square suspended her account because of, quote, high-risk activity. When she tried to find out more, she was told phone support was only available for customers with current accounts. She said she didn't get her $20,000 back until she wrote a letter to the company's CEO. Square told us these holds are rare, but, quote, sometimes when we don't get enough information, we hold funds for a period of time that allows us to protect against the risk of chargebacks. Newberry says he'll be using another credit card processor if he's still in business by the time he gets his money back.
It's like having your hands tied and putting somebody strangling you and you can't do nothing.
Now, I sent an email out to all of you, or those of you who are signed up with us last week, or this week. I get confused now. And the problem that we have is that because of who we are, our domain is being blocked, or not necessarily blocked, but determined that we are spam. We are nothing more than garbage. So every single one of you listening to me, if you did not get an email and you're signed up with us, check your spam folder, check your junk folder. What's happening is these corporations that, like Google and with Gmail and MSN and AOL and Yahoo, and I can name 100 more, these are all part of the deep state. They're controlling propaganda parts of the internet. They will determine what you can read and what you can't. And so what they do is they shift us right directly over to your junk file, your spam file, your garbage file. Look in there. If we send an email out to you, that's where it's going to be. And I sent an email out, and I told everyone that we can't take credit cards now. The problem is that we have, you know, like, what is this? Maybe 5% of our whole items that we sell, the products that we sell, is CBD. But all of a sudden, because that, a lot of these companies have decided that we're criminals. And only criminals will sell CBD. I mean, hell, you look at it, you just drive down Government Way here, you'll see 17 different places selling CBD. The 7-Eleven on the corner, the barbershop, the massage parlor. I mean, it's like Coca-Cola now, it seems. Unfortunately, 99% of it out there is crap. And it's cheap, and the government is now looking at it as fraud because there are a lot of people trying to sell CBD that don't even have CBD in it. Just a bunch of essential oils. But regardless of that, I sent out an email. I sent out over 6,000 emails. 900 of them were opened. That means 900 of you out of 6,000 said, oh, look, there's a warning from Survival Enterprises on credit card processing. And you opened it. I don't know why I waste my time, but it's for the 900 people that did open it is why I waste my time. But what I told everyone is we can't take credit cards now. So if you walk in the store, it's either going to be cash or a check, period. And the funny thing is I have a big sign on the front door, and then I have a big sign on the cash register, and both of them say cash only. And we still had half a dozen people yesterday come in and try and use a credit card. I said, well, there's a sign here. Well, I didn't see it. How about the one on the door that you had to look at when you grabbed the handle? But we can take what's called an e-check. And this is a unique product that was authorized this year by the U.S. government. It's very simple. You call us up on the phone, tell us what you want. We figure out the cost and the shipping and do everything right there. And then you give us your routing number, your bank account number, your check number, your name, address, you know, all the standard stuff that's on a check. And it's put into a highly secure server, which prints up a check. And then we simply take the check and we take it to our bank. It's that simple. So instead of being able to order right online, I mean, you can order online. And then what will happen is Angie will call you or somebody will call you, get all your information, and then we'll handle it that way. And yeah, we have people who send us checks, but how that works is you send us a check. That's going to take 2 to 4 days to get to us. And then we have to take that check and we have to deposit it. And that's going to take another 3 to 4 days to clear. So you're looking at a minimum of a week time lag before we can ship your product. Whereas you call us on the phone, give us your order, we take the e-check, and we deposit it that day. And then usually we're going to ship about 2 business days from there because it's extremely secure. And I mean, this is extremely secure. So that's our option right now. Of course, you can still send cash, gold, and silver. We always take that. Today's show is just basically going to be warnings. This is warning that we're getting to a crescendo. The powers that be, whatever word you want to use, Illuminati, deep state, establishment, they're scared. I watched all the hearings this week with the communists against the Republicans, and it was embarrassingly astounding because I also, over time, had watched kangaroo courts from Russia. and different communist nations. Except in the United States, they don't take you out immediately and put a bullet in your head and let you fall into a trench in the ground. Yet. But I am going to be giving you warnings. There's things that are happening in the United States. And there's things that can happen. And there's things that will happen. And none of them are going to be good. Once we get a government in a position which we have right now, it controls everything. But what controls it? This is the problem that I'm just not smart enough to figure out. Trump is not the government. But the minions are all the senators and the congressmen and our so-called government departments and agencies. These are disgusting creatures that we were warned about by our founding fathers that should never have occurred, and we allowed it to occur. So what we're going to do is I'm just going to hodgepodge around, and I'm going to talk to you about various things. The Federal Reserve, our economy. Now, you know what's been going on with the economy. Outwardly, we're looking, it's doing great. There's all kinds of jobs out there, and the only reason someone doesn't have a job is because they don't want a job. They either have their lips firmly attached to the government's teat, or they have another source of income, which is fine, you know, work under the table. Or they've got sucked into the Democrats' vision of victimhood, and they're on welfare, and that's the way they want to stay. But what's happening right now, and I've talked to you about this, the Federal Reserve pumping money into the banks, it has not gotten better. From today, from the 15th of December through the beginning of January, the Federal Reserve is going to have to put $500 billion into the banks in the United States to keep them functioning. Because the banks, if the Federal Reserve stood back, we would have 7 days and all the banks in the United States would fail. I don't mean maybe. This is real. That's a warning to you. Okay, now that's under the economy. Now, you know, I have different categories I do. I do economy, I do health and food, I do Islam, I do the liberal psychosis. And we're going to jump around. We're going directly to the liberal psychosis. And I want you to listen to me, okay? So I'm ranting. I don't give a damn. You want to know where there's Democrats. You want to know who the enemy are. The enemy is Democrat. I refuse to use the word democratic. They are not. Where you have intolerance, you can't say what you want to say, because you'll be screamed down or beat up. You can't argue with the psychosis of liberalism, because they'll attack you. They'll use names against you. They'll cancel your credit card processing. So where you have intolerance, gun control, high crime, high taxes, where you hear socialism, communism promoted as a valid political viewpoint, where you have high unemployment, where you have concrete plantations for blacks. The blacks in the United States, very few of them have ever left the plantations. Who owned the plantations in the South? The Democrats. You know what I find funny as hell? These slobbering social justice warriors want all of the statues torn down for their famous Confederate generals and such. They were all Democrats. So where you have failed schools, where you have high levels of government interference in business and building, where you have sexual diseases rampant, where the dregs of life are legally destroying cities, where you have willful and promoted murder of the unborn, where you see sexual perversion promoted to children, where you see insane disrespect to those around them, where you see sexual deviance promoted as role models, where lying is used openly and continuously to win an argument, where fraudulent propaganda is mainstream news, where you find the deep state, where there's political corruption on a massive scale, where the elites rule. That's where you find Democrats. Always. I found a clip this week with Ronald Reagan speaking and a bunch of these communists speaking. You can call them Democrats if you want to. You can call them socialists. You can call them communists. Progressives is a good word. But regardless, in this clip, you can tell when a true American speaks, and when one of these communist pretenders speak.
Whether we believe in our capacity for self-government or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves.
Give us more authority and more ability.
For all of this talk about rules, we make them up as we go along.
A government can't control the economy without controlling people. And they know when a government sets out to do that, it must use force and coercion to achieve its purpose.
Put the legislation together to control the people.
We'll go through the gate's closed, we'll go over the fence is too high, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in, but we're going to get health care reform passed.
They also knew, those founding fathers, that outside of its legitimate functions, government does nothing as well or as economically as the private sector of the economy.
Needs to be a focus on an immediate increase in spending.
I mean, I do think at a certain point you've made enough money.
The more the plans fail, the more the planners plan.
You're telling me we got to go spend money to keep from going bankrupt? The answer, yes, I'm telling you.
We have so many people who can't see a fat man standing beside a thin one without coming to the conclusion the fat man got that way by taking advantage of the thin one.
I think there are a lot of very rich people out there whom we can tax at a point down the road and recover some of this money.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
They'll be crying out for public options.
It's the cost, I think, of having the kind of America that we want to have.
Our natural unalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government. And freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment.
I don't worry about the Constitution on this, to be honest.
What good is reading the bill if it's 1,000 pages?
You have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
Those voices don't speak for the rest of us. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth.
There have been times where America's shown arrogance.
Well, I think it's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the founding fathers.
And after listening to that, I was sent another clip, which brought tears to my eyes, not because of what it said, but because of where we have ended up. We have half of the population of the United States wants a free and true America based on the founding fathers. The other half want perversion, disgust, illegality. No white people, no Christians, no males. They want us deluded to be nothing more than another third world crap hole.
There was a lawyer once. His name was Francis Scott Key. He penned a song that I'm sure you're aware of. You've seen it. It's in most hymnals throughout our churches. It's called the National Anthem. It is our song as an American. We go, however, to a ball game, we stand in our church services, and we sing the words of that song, and they float over our minds and our lips, and we don't even realize what we're singing. Most of us have memorized it as a child, but we've never really thought about what it means. Let me tell you a story. Francis Scott Key was a lawyer in Baltimore. The colonies were engaged in vicious conflict with the mother country, Britain. Because of this conflict and the protractedness of it, they had accumulated prisoners on both sides. The American colonies had prisoners and the British had prisoners. And the American government initiated a move. They went to the British and they said, "Let us negotiate for the release of these prisoners." They said, "We want to send a man out to discuss this with you." They were holding the American prisoners in boats about 1,000 yards offshore. And they said, "We want to send a man by the name of Francis Scott Key. He will come out and negotiate to see if we can make a mutual exchange." On the appointed day, in a rowboat, he went out to this boat and he negotiated with the British officials. And they reached a conclusion that men could be exchanged on a one-for-one basis. Francis Scott Key, jubilant with the fact that he'd been successful, went down below in the boats, and what he found was a cargo hold full of humanity, men. And he said, "Men, I've got news for you tonight. You're free." He said, "Tonight I have negotiated successfully your return to the colonies." He said, "You'll be taken out of this boat, out of this filth, out of your chains." As he went back up on board to arrange for their passage to the shore, the admiral came and he said, "We have a slight problem." He said, "We will still honor our commitment to release these men, but it'll be merely academic after tonight. It won't matter." And Francis Scott Key said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, Mr. Key," he said, "tonight we have laid an ultimatum. upon the colonies. Your people will either capitulate and lay down the colors of that flag that you think so much of, or you see that fort right over there, Fort Henry? He said, we're going to remove it from the face of the earth. He said, how are you going to do that? He said, if you will, scan the horizon of the sea. And as he looked, he could see hundreds of little dots. And he said, that's the entire British war fleet. He said, all of the gunpowder, all of the armament is being called upon to demolish that fort. It will be here within striking distance in a matter of about 2.5 hours. He said, the war is over. These men would be free anyway. He said, you can't shell that fort. He said, that's a large fort. He said, it's full of women and children. He says, it's predominantly not a military fort. They said, don't worry about it. They said, we've left them a way out. And he said, what's that? He said, do you see that flag way up on the rampart? He said, we have told them that if they will lower that flag, the shelling will stop immediately. And we'll know that they've surrendered, and you'll now be under British rule. Francis Scott Key went down below and told the men what was about to happen. And they said, how many ships? He said, hundreds. The ships got closer. Francis Scott Key went back up on top and he said, men, I'll shout down to you what's going on as we watch. As twilight began to fall, and as the haze hung over the ocean as it does at sunset, suddenly the British war fleet unleashed. He says, the sound was deafening. There were so many guns that there were no reliefs. He said, it was absolutely impossible to talk or hear. He said, suddenly the sky, although dark, was suddenly lit. And he says, from down below, all he could hear the men, the prisoners, saying was, tell us where the flag is. What have they done with the flag? Is the flag still flying over the rampart? Tell us. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours into the shelling. Every time the bomb would explode and it would be close to the flag, they could see the flag in the illuminated red glare of that bomb. And Francis Scott Key would report down to the men below, it's still up. It's not down. The admiral came and he said, your people are insane. He said, what's the matter with them? He said, don't they understand this is an impossible situation? Francis Scott Key said, he remembered what George Washington had said. He said, the thing that sets the American Christian apart from all other people in the world is he will die on his feet before he'll live on his knees. The admiral said, we have now instructed all of the guns to focus on the rampart to take that flag down. He said, we don't understand something. Our reconnaissance tells us that that flag has been hit directly again and again and again, and yet it's still flying. We don't understand that. But he said, now we're about to bring every gun for the next 3 hours to bear on that point. Francis Scott Key said the barrage was unmerciful. All that he could hear was the men down below praying. The prayer. God, keep that flag flying where we last saw it. Sunrise came. He said there was a heavy mist hanging over the land, but the rampart was tall enough. There stood the flag, completely nondescript, in shreds. The flagpole itself was at a crazy angle, but the flag was still at the top. Francis Scott Key went aboard and immediately went into Fort Henry to see what had happened. And what he found had happened was that that flagpole and that flag had suffered repetitious direct hits. And when hit had fallen, but men, fathers, who knew what it meant for that flag to be on the ground, although knowing that all of the British guns were trained on it, walked over and held it up humanly until they died. Their bodies were removed and others took their place. Francis Scott Key said what held that flagpole in place at that unusual angle were patriots' bodies. He penned the song, "Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming. Or the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that the flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet fly and wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? The debt was demanded. The price, it was paid.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting.
From that stirring image of sacrifice and patriotism, we go to Virginia now. Virginia, which has been bought and paid for by one of the guys running for president. And you see his phony communist ads all over the TV, all over the United States. Bloomberg bought and paid for all of the Democrats that took over Virginia. Virginia is now a communist paradise. They are ready, as of January 1st, to start curtailing the superfluous rights that the U.S. citizens in Virginia have been abusing, from their viewpoint, for the past, oh, I don't know, 200-something years. This is such a contrast.
For all of you, it'll never happen in my state, folks out there. I direct you to Virginia. Virginia was once a deeply red state and one of the most pro-gun states in the country. And overnight, is now a blue state and on the verge of becoming one of the most anti-gun states in the country. I'm no Crip or Blood political gangbanger, so I'm not here to tell you that the Republicans are our political lord and saviors. But I am here to tell you that Democrats have once again proven themselves to be anti-Second Amendment, and I cannot support any party that is anti any constitutional right, especially one of the most important, if not the most important right. Want to know who the largest outside spender in the elections were to make this flip happen? One of the largest anti-gun groups in the country, Everytown for Gun Safety. They spent $2.5 million in this election. Guess who funds Everytown for Gun Safety? The political megalomaniac himself, billionaire, and to me, the most anti-gun person on the planet, Michael Stop and Frisk All the Black People Bloomberg. And now, the same anti-two-way megalomaniac is running to be the president. This man by himself outspent every gun rights organization in the country. I can call Bloomberg all the names in the world, but make no mistake, this man is not playing around. And he has the means to do and get exactly what he wants. And Virginia is a prime example of what he wants. Right now, Virginia is facing SB 16, a bill that is more restrictive than states with the most strict gun control laws currently. SB 16 doesn't ban assault rifles. No, that's not broad enough. It seeks to ban assault firearms and magazines over 10 rounds. And in typical fashion, they make up a definition of assault firearm that includes essentially every modern semi-automatic rifle and shotgun, along with any pistol that weighs over 50 ounces unloaded. To make matters worse, it includes a catch-all phrase in the definition banning any characteristic of like kind. What does that even mean? It means you have to guess whether or not a part on your rifle meets the definition of assault firearm and hope you don't go to jail for guessing wrong. There's not a grandfather clause. That means whatever gun you owned before the law is put into place, you have to give it up or go to jail. I believe they call that a gun confiscation. There's SB 18, which makes it a felony to purchase a firearm unless you're over 21. Not 21, but over 21. That would mean in the state of Virginia, you can vote, go to the military, get married, serve on a jury, but you can't own a gun to protect your life and your family. SB 18 also makes it a felony to allow anyone under 18 to be in possession of a firearm by themselves. I haven't even gotten to SB 64 yet. The language in SB 64 is soft. Anyone taking a training class and then subsequently showing up to a 2A rally or demonstration with a gun on them can be found guilty, along with the trainer and the owner of the range where the training took place. You can be charged with unlawful paramilitary activity, which is a felony, if you train or train with someone knowing or having reason to know they're going to use that training in furtherance of civil disorder. Also, if you assemble with one or more people with the intent of intimidating any person or group of persons by drilling, parading, or marching with any firearm. But that sounds like not only attack on the Second, but the First Amendment. Simply having a gun on you is considered intimidating to most anti-gunners. You want to peacefully counter-protest another protest, but want to carry a gun for protection? Can't do it, because it'll be seen as you wanting to intimidate. Imagine that. In 2019, carrying a gun for protection while exercising your First Amendment rights will now be considered a form of intimidation. I'm telling you, the days of feeling like you don't need to vote because you're in a traditionally pro-gun state are over. Anti-gun Democrats are fleeing traditionally anti-gun states like California and moving to places like Virginia and Texas in droves. And for whatever ridiculous reason, they're voting for the same type of politicians that were responsible for them leaving their previous state in the first place. I will never understand this. You leave one state because of the terrible policies only to go to another state and vote the same way, expecting a different result. But that's exactly what a lot of these people do. On top of that, you have people migrating from countries with oppressive or corrupt governments where they had less freedom, but then come to America where we have more freedom, but then vote for politicians here in America who are trying to mimic the same oppressive policies they ran from in their previous country. I just don't get it. Either way, the complacency in the gun community has got to stop. We're not even playing defense anymore. We're just losing. We look up every election season like, oh crap, where did our rights go? They're going the way of the dodo bird because we think it's enough to just call the other side stupid and sit back in our pro-2A state house of cards. We have to stop doing this to ourselves. Enough with the infighting and this who's the purest 2A patriot BS. We are all on the same side. Want to give money to the NRA? Give money to the NRA. Want to give money to GOA, FPC, NAGA? I don't care. They're all fighting the same fight because I promise, while we're infighting, Bloomberg and gang are hitting us from all sides, in the mainstream media, social media, politically, culturally, on the state level, the federal level, financially, you name it. They are kicking our ass. As two-way supporters, our job is harder. All they have to do is throw money around and misinform the masses, where we have to educate people, fight political battles, find ways around social media and mainstream media blackballing, hold so-called pro-gun politicians accountable, and give your hard-earned money to gun rights organizations that are having to deal with the same BS as we are. But no one said protecting freedom would be easy. It's hard. It sucks. It's a thankless job. And by and large, people are going to think you're weird. But it has to be done. It just is what it is. We're better than this. We don't have the privilege of resting. There's no coasting or vacations. Whether you're politicking, making videos, holding rallies, training people, educating people, to me, it's all advocacy. And in this fight for our freedom, we need all hands on deck. Because make no mistake, I don't care what state you live in. It can happen in your state. Hell, Texas almost voted for Beto, and he bragged about wanting to take people's guns.
Now we're going to jump back to an exclusive interview from One American News. Now, I don't know about you guys. Drudge is gone. They're no longer even an American company, drudgereport.com. They're offshore. They're owned by a foreign entity. They are nothing more than a propaganda arm of the deep state, the establishment, worldwide, it seems now. Fox is gone. I have a clip on for Fox that I'll play later. I don't have time for it now. But do you remember when the former U.S. Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch lied in the hearing, the so-called inquiry, the impeachment inquiry to the Democrats? She lied, and she could tell she was lying when she was speaking. I don't know why I was fired. I have no idea. UAN got an exclusive interview, and no mainstream picked it up. I think I'm the only person ever to put it on the air.
Now we want to go to Budapest, Hungary, where One America's Chanel Rion has been tracking down Ukrainian witnesses as part of an exclusive OAN investigative series dismantling the Adam Schiff impeachment hoax.
In an exclusive interview with One America News, Ukrainian former Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko says Yovanovitch perjured herself before Congress and America, and he has the documents to prove it.
You inherited Mr. Shokin's Prosecutor General office. Describe for us your first interaction with the U.S. Embassy in this position.
So everything was good, but then Yovanovitch visited me.
Ambassador Yovanovitch.
Ambassador Yovanovitch and Mr. Kent. They visited me for small negotiation or talking.
Did they visit you in your office?
Yes. Firstly, I visited her in her office, and then it was the second meeting, but the first in my office. They visited me, and we spoke normally, and she asked me to change some old deputies.
For context, when Obama's point man for Ukraine, Joe Biden, bragged about how he threatened to withhold $1 billion in U.S. aid in order to successfully fire the prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, Biden paints himself the hero, performing a public service.
I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money.
Biden never mentioned the fact his son Hunter was on the board of Burisma, Ukraine's largest oil and gas company. Biden also never mentioned the fact that the prosecutor he got fired was investigating Burisma. This conflict of interest raised little actual interest amongst the media. That's when our interview Yuri Lutsenko inherited the fired prosecutor's office. But soon after the inheritance, Lutsenko received an interesting visit.
But then she asked me to close case of one person. I said, no, it is impossible. I couldn't close any case without investigation. So I took a piece of paper and I write these three, not cases, but enemies: Kasko, Leshenko, Shabunin, Madam Ambassador. Let's continue your untouchable list. She asked me, why are you so serious? And then I destroyed this list. While I am general prosecutor, no president, no ambassador could announce me such lists. That was the full story. So she ran immediately from the office, and my boy near office doors asked me, what you told her? His red face, very angry. I didn't agree to receive any orders to open or to close criminal cases.
Fast forward to Adam Schiff's impeachment inquiry, and Schiff called up Ambassador Yovanovitch to testify. Lutsenko says he was shocked to watch Yovanovitch's testimony when she said she never gave him such a list. Technically, says Lutsenko, no, she never gave him a list. The list still came from her. When Lutsenko found a case in which $7 billion went to the U.S. via possible money laundering to a firm called Franklin Templeton, he wanted help from the U.S. Justice Department to track down and retrieve this money. Ambassador Yovanovitch, says Lutsenko, played the obstructor.
I was once again shocked when Madame Yovanovitch told to members of the committee that Lutsenko asked me to organize his meeting with American Attorney General. But you know, gentlemen, that there is a procedure for this. The procedure that Lutsenko must give us and short topic what points he wants to discuss with American law enforcement bodies, Yovanovitch said. And he never gave us such an information. I have bad news for Madame Yovanovitch. This is my letter, my deputy letter, to request for cooperation in investigation against the criminal organization of Yanukovych and regarding possible investment in the U.S.-based mutual and other funds for the purpose of money laundering.
Stay tuned. For more bombshells from this exclusive interview, watch for the next part in our One America News Investigates episode. I'm Chanel Rion for One America News.
You need to find One America News and start watching it. I do, and it is news. It's not opinion like on all of the other mainstream media. Now, look, my next show is going to be my Christmas show, and it's going to be an old-time theater, radio theater, Miracle on 34th Street, and It's a Wonderful Life. And I hope you listen to it, and I hope you enjoy it. And then the end of the month of December is going to be a replay of one of my shows. So I want to wish you all Merry Christmas. I want to wish you all a happy and safe next year, which I highly doubt, because we have, as I said, two factions in the United States. We have Americans and we have communists. And it's easy to see what the communists are. They call themselves Democrats. They call themselves Antifa. They call themselves, I mean, there's 1,000 names. But regardless of it is, whatever it is, keep your mind focused on your own survival and your family's survival. They are all that's worthy of your attention. So this is the Armchair Survivalist signing off for now. But the last part of this show is going to be a show that I have done every year since 2007. It's called The Great Depression or Deja Vu All Over Again. It's fairly self-explanatory. I did some research on a guy named Studs Terkel. He interviewed all these people who were living at the time or whose parents had lived during the Great Depression. My grandparents survived the Great Depression. And As I said, this show is warnings. This is a warning. When the Federal Reserve has to pump billions of dollars into our banks, this is a house of straw, and anything can bring it down. So just remember and enjoy. See you next year.
And everywhere you go, times are harder than they've ever been before. You know, people are drifting from door to door, but they can't find no heaven, don't care where they go. Mm-hmm. can't get up on this heart killing flow. Lord, I won't get down. Town is low no more. Will you hear me singing this song? Oh, lonesome song. People, you know these hard times can't last for so long.
Ladies and gentlemen, to a special episode of the Armchair Survivalist. This is titled The Great Depression or Deja Vu All Over Again. Those of you who listen to me, I did this show November of 07. Basically, what I was trying to tell you is something very simple. Those that don't learn from history will repeat it. Welcome to history. When I did this show in 07, the things that I talked about just starting to transpire. But I guess that wasn't enough because people didn't pay that much attention. Because in 08, the first socialist Muslim, Barack Hussein Obama, was elected president of the United States in the first of its kind openly racist, socialist, communist election. He was put into power by the efforts of the entitlement voters. These are the people who live off government handouts. You know who they are. Or the people who get rich as poverty pimps by using the ignorant as a power base. Since the election, 56 million Americans have lost their jobs. Unemployment filings average 400,000 a week and have since the first week the abomination's been in office. Over 43 million people are on food stamps. Almost 400 banks have closed. Over 3 million homes have been foreclosed on. Businesses are in the Dow Jones. It's 30 companies. These are the major movers on the planet. They don't really give a damn about what's happening in America because they were smart enough years ago to get out. So their business is now international. They're all in foreign countries. If you watch the stock market this week, it was like watching a yo-yo championship. Up, down, up, down, up, down. But you know what? Every single time it went down, it was because of something going on overseas, not something happening in the United States, because the stock market is totally separate from what is happening in the United States. And I want to tell you again, those that don't learn from history are bound to repeat it. What do you think? That's just something that people spew out now and then, or something you read in a comic book, or once in history class you might have read it somewhere? The first time I heard this, it was said in a different manner by Socrates thousands of years ago. I was raised pretty much by my grandfather. He was born in 1900, so he saw the whole of the Depression firsthand. I grew up poor, and I'm not wearing that as a badge. That's just a statement of fact. But I learned how to stretch a nickel. I was working, making money when I was 6 years old. Well, now that's illegal because, you know, children have rights too, you know. I learned what a dollar meant before I was 10 years old, and it wasn't a piece of paper. For my chores at home, I got 10 cents a week, which I instantly ran to the corner drugstore and blew on a Coke and a Babe Ruth candy bar. 10 cents a week. I was in hog heaven. Once a week, Mama would buy a pizza, half gallon of cottage cheese, and a dozen comic books for all of us. It sounds kind of strange, but that's what we got. Pizza and cottage cheese. I loved it. But the thing that I learned as a kid was how to stretch a nickel. How to use what I knew to survive. So you get this concept that's been spewed about of, oh, you got to adapt to the environment. You got to adapt to what's happening. Horse crap. You have to adapt your environment so that you can survive in it better. And that's what I was taught. I was taught how to make my environment more conducive to my survival. That's called using your wits. And those of you who know what I'm talking about, Grandpa also taught me how to make rock soup. I'm not going to go into it now, but also the term hobo stew. He also taught me how to fish, how to hunt, how to track. And I tell you, to this day, I don't do any of that for sport. If I go out hunting or fishing, it's for food. I remember one time years ago, every opening season, fish trout season, me and all my friends would go up to Kuybers, Northern California, and we'd
camp out for about a week. A lot of beer drinking, a lot of cooking and food and camaraderie and horseshoe playing and fishing. We couldn't get up there for about 3 days. And finally, everybody else is already up there. So this is when my son Eric was 4 or 5 months old. So we finally got to go up. About 3 days later, I show up there, and everybody's like, "Hey, no fish. No fish in this river at all. This South Fork Yuba River. There's no fish up here at all." I said, "No, guys, there's fish up there. It's a poor carpenter that blames his tools. So there's plenty of fish out there. You just got to know how to get them." And they told me I was full of crap. Well, I said, "Look, I can't get in where the fish are with this van I'm driving. I need to borrow somebody. I need to borrow your Jeep." And the guy said, "No, you're full of crap. You just don't touch my Jeep. I'm not letting you drive it." Well, the next morning, I got up at 4 a.m., hot-wired a Jeep, and took off. 7 a.m. I was back. And if Bill's listening to this show, he'll remember this, because I showed up and Bill goes, "Where the hell's the fish?" I said, "Well, Bill, they're in the ice chest behind me." He opened the ice chest. There were about 31 trout. He didn't say a word. He just held his hand out. I gave him my knife and he took them all down and cleaned them. That's how I was taught. I am not into this sports crap. We were taught how to eat. We were taught how to survive. He also taught me, Grandpa also taught me something interesting, that government is evil, period. There's no such thing as any government that isn't evil. A couple hundred years ago, they were set up to not be evil, but it kind of transposed themselves into becoming evil. And I mean city, county, state, and federal. And the only reason they exist and the only thought process that all governments have is how they could buy votes for their next election. And that's what they do. Everything they can, everything the government does is so that they can get more votes for the next election. And I don't care, Republican, communist, socialist, Democrat, it doesn't matter. They're all the same. Grandpa also explained to me the concept of corporations. I don't care about Black's Law Dictionary and explaining exactly what the definitions are. Corporations are giant businesses that exist as if they're a ghost. They have no one single person you can point your finger at and say, "That's the son of a bitch that caused the problem." Corporations control America. But the thing that I did get from Grandpa is the ability to see. Do you know what that means? And I don't mean just to eyeball. I'm going to read you a definition, because people don't know what it means to see. Just poking your eyes at something and go, "Oh, I can see that." See, to perceive with the eyes, to apprehend as if by the sense of sight, such as see with one's fingers, to have a mental image of, visualize, to understand, comprehend. I have the right and the ability to evaluate what's right and wrong. And I actually know what's right and wrong. And I've got the willingness to learn. Now, these are things that people don't have. I am willing to learn. There's three ways to learn. One way is by trying yourself and failing, which is a stupid way to learn. And generally, it's the idiots amongst us that have to learn that way, because they're too arrogant to listen to an expert tell them, "Don't do that. Don't stick your hand on a fire. It will burn." Or you can watch others succeed or fail. I don't think I should stick my hand in that gopher's hole, considering there's a gopher hooked at that guy's fingers now. Or by education. And I don't mean schooling. I mean by, reading something, practicing doing something. I have the ability to evaluate, to figure out whether or not something would work based on my memories, my intelligence, and what I've learned over the years. This week I had a conversation with a customer coming to the store who wanted to know what a true survivalist is, what a true prepper is. And I said, "Well, it's real simple. It's somebody who knows who Murphy is." He looks at me and goes, "Who the hell is Murphy?" I said, "Murphy, don't you know Murphy? Murphy's laws. Murphy has a rule. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong." And learning that and understanding that concept makes you a survivalist. If it can go wrong, it will. So if you can run out of food, you will. So store up food. If your gun can jam at the wrong moment, keep it cleaned and oiled. If you're going to trip over that electrical cord, get it the hell out of the way. Thinking ahead and setting your whole life. See, it's foreign to me to have to train myself to not stick my head in a lion's mouth. There's an old saying, don't stick your head in a lion's mouth if you don't want it bit. Problem is, too many people have no clue who Murphy is or why he would even matter. I have this producer from the Discovery Channel trying to get a hold of me. They want to do a series on survivalists, and they want to get survivalists, preppers, who are willing to allow television to film all of their preps and them and have them talk about it. She started off a couple of weeks ago hitting everybody, all the blogs and the other radio. They got like three people that are willing to stupidly show them everything they did and have. And it just shows me the imbecilic concepts that the general public have about thinking ahead or even paying attention to the past. I'm going to read you something Abraham Lincoln said, January 27th, 1838. At what point shall we expect the approach of danger? By what means shall we fortify against it? Shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined with all the treasures of the earth in their military chest with a Bonaparte for a commander could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. And what Lincoln was saying with that, America's downfall will come from within. It will come from the ignorance of the population. It will come from the willingness of the population to follow the footsteps of those who have failed before them. Everyone makes mistakes. I'm not going to degrade people by saying, oh, that's just being human. That's BS. People make a mistake out of ignorance, out of confusion. Insulting somebody and calling them human is just an excuse. But what's been happening for the past 100 years is that people are simply, by choice, taking the path of least resistance. Some years ago, I was at a yard sale, and I buy books because that's where knowledge is. And I saw this book by a guy named Studs Terkel, titled Hard Times, An Oral History of the Great Depression. She wanted all of 10 cents for this book. I thought, well, that's not a bad deal. So I bought it because I'd heard of Studs Terkel. I'd listened to some of his radio shows. He was born in 1912. He grew up in Chicago, graduated from the University of Chicago in 32, and from the law school, Chicago Law School in 34. He has been in radio soap operas. He's been a disc jockey, a sports commentator. He's traveled all over the world doing on-the-spot interviews, and this is where I heard about him. He had a daily radio program, WFMT in Chicago, and WRVR in New York City. He interviewed people. He interviewed people that would not talk to anyone, but they'd talk to him. So I figured, you know, I'm going to read this book. That's kind of cute. After the first 10 pages, I was crying too hard to continue reading it. I couldn't read it. I couldn't sit down and read this thing straight through. This is history. This isn't some elitist writing history. This is an oral history. This is he interviewed people who survived the Depression, people whose children suffered because of the Depression. And he talked to them and recorded these interviews. This book, Hard Times, I advise you finding it if you can. It is something that you need to look at. Forewarned is forearmed. I know everybody's heard of the Wall Street crash of 1929. 1929? Was it 32? I thought it was 1908. I bet 75% of the people out there don't even know what the stock market crash means. It's a sudden dramatic decline of stock prices across a significant cross-section of a stock market, resulting in a significant loss of paper wealth. You understand what they're saying is paper wealth. That doesn't mean your commodities you have in hand, your gold, guns, lead, food, loses value. The economy had been growing robustly for most of the so-called roaring 20s. It was a technological golden age as innovations such as radio, automobiles, aviation, telephone, and the power grid were deployed and adopted. Companies that pioneered these advances, like RCA and General Motors, their stocks soared. On August 24th, 1921, the Dow Jones stood at a value of 64. By September 3rd, 1929, it had risen to about 381. By the summer of 1929, it was clear that the economy was contracting and the stock market went through a series of unsettling price declines. On December 24th, known as Black Thursday, and October 29th, known as Black Tuesday, it came to head. On Black Tuesday, the Dow average fell 38 points to 260 points. Now, that was a drop of 12.8%. Now, what you need to look at is the percentage. They used to have ticker tape machines, little glass jars, little printers, and they would tick out. They'd print out these long strips that tell you what the stock was at. These ticker tape machines were overwhelmed. Telephone lines and telegraphs were clogged. People were trying to sell their stocks so fast and hard, they couldn't get to it in time to sell them. By the end of the weekend of November 11th, Dow Jones stood at about 228. It was a 40% drop. Before bottoming it out in 1932, the Dow Jones lost 89% of their value. That's the stock market crash. American businesses lost over $30 billion in value in just a few days. Thousands of businesses went belly up overnight, and I mean that literally. You'd be at work Friday, you come back to work Monday, and there's a sign in a door saying closed, out of business. Hundreds and thousands of people lost their jobs. Now, you've got to look at this in a percentage. There are hundreds and thousands of people losing their job weekly now in the United States. Weekly. Within weeks, there were thousands of homes that were foreclosed on. See, at that time, if you're late a week, banks would come in and snag your home.
Remembers her father. Remembers also mortgages and the payment of mortgages in the 30s.
I can remember how he used to scrimp and scrape to make his mortgage payment. He borrowed money from a loan company quite frequently when he couldn't make a mortgage payment. And then the loan company had to be paid. And I remember the tension in the house when Pa, as we call him, He used to scramble around to get enough money to pay that loan installment. And, you know, that was the one degrading thing that I can remember in the Depression, that I remember going downtown to the loan company and paying the loan. And I used to hate that. I don't know why I felt it was so degrading. I suppose it may be that I knew about what we had to do, you know, to gather the money together, and I knew how irritable my father would be. So I used to feel degraded when I had to go down and pay that loan.
Do you think you, even though you weren't affected harshly by it, as others might have been, your being a child or a young girl, a young woman of depression, has affected your attitude toward things, toward property, toward money?
To me, anybody that would go out and borrow money to pay for something and pay for it on time is just absolutely ridiculous. I just wouldn't do that. The worst thing that I find that I have to do every month is pay my mortgage, because I hate to see that interest being paid. And if I had the money, I'd pay it all up. I just loathe it, really. I mean, don't get me started.
No, no, go ahead.
I just can't understand anybody buying anything on installments. I'd rather go without. Maybe it is really goes back to perhaps the loan company. I'll be darned if I'm going to pay anybody any money that really they shouldn't have. And I can remember going into it, and it was one of the, I won't mention the name, but it was a well-known loan company. But when I walked in, it seemed to me that it was dingy, and yet I'm sure that it wasn't. And it must be just the way I felt, that there was something not quite right about it.
Now, the gentleman you heard speaking was Tud Sterkle. Stud Sterkle. Sorry, I got that bass backwards. He had the ability to pull things out of people. The thing in the Depression is that people prior to that had been raised to be self-sufficient. They'd been raised that the man, his job was to work. His job was to be self-sufficient and work hard and provide for your family. And his job wasn't to stand in line and beg for food. His job wasn't to stand in line and hope that out of the 2,000 guys in front of him, they'd pick him to go work for a day.
I'm in a cab right now. I'm talking to a young cab driver. If I say to you the American Depression, what comes to your mind?
Well, I remember the Depression. Of course, I was too small, but I do remember my father telling me what he'd done during the Depression. He spent 2 years painting his father's house. He painted it twice. It gave him something to do, and it prevented him from, you know, completely losing all his, well, I wouldn't say self-respect, because after all, he was in a position where there were many, many people who were also out of work, so he certainly wasn't alone. He had been working on construction before that. I think he told me that he had been working, putting up the old Equitable building downtown, I think it's 100 Broadway. He was working on walking on the steel beams. They ran out of steam here in New York, and the construction ran out around, I guess just around the end of the 20s, around the end of 28 or 29. He never, not only never forgot it, I suppose it left an emotional impression on him. I think it does something to somebody to be out of work for that length of time. And it's possible that it can affect your confidence in yourself. It's not that it destroyed his self-confidence, because he always did very well and he had a good job. I could feel, you know, that it affected his outlook on life, his reaction towards business and towards success. You know, I always thought he had a kind of inordinately impressed by men who had made it in business, you know. It's my own feeling that the depression had something to do with this.
Every day, I have people ask, when is the end going to come? When is the Schumer going to hit the fan? And I look at them and say, it already is for many people. The world is ending for many people. There are, every day, there are people out there who lost their job, lost their home, had everything burnt to the ground, and they're standing there with nothing but what they have on their back. Every day is the end of the world for someone. And the reverse of that is that most people have no clue what's going on, so they're just as happy as always. You don't really know what's going on. You think that people are lying to you when they tell you, oh yeah, we're having a depression right now. We're in a depression.
I was supposedly at that time in my life was very unfortunate, because I was raised in an orphanage. Let's say I went into the home, I think it was 1933, about 10 and a half years old.
Here in Chicago.
It was here in Chicago. It was on the west side of 15th and Albany. I don't know, I had clean clothes all the time, and we had plenty to eat. We had lessons. When you talk about food, when I see so much food now and that, I remember this period when we used to walk to Harrison High School. We would go to Douglas Park, and the railroad tracks came somewhere, and you would see the men there waiting for us to go through and hand them our lunches. If we would have something, you know, that the dietitian at the home would prepare that we didn't like, we would give them the little brown paper bags.
Were these, what kind of men were they?
They were guys who would probably work if there was work to do. They weren't the type. Now, today, I would usually have say studs that I would tell my daughters, you got to be careful of people, especially a certain types that look a certain way or that. I don't know. But then, either it was, we didn't have fear because we were younger, because I think it was depression time. Nobody was really your enemy. These were guys who didn't work, who didn't have work. And they would probably ride the rails, or I don't know how they got where they were going or wherever they ended up or that. But I remember on Friday, we used to give them our lunch. However, there might have been 125 of us going off to Harrison High School carrying the same brown paper bag with mashed sardine sandwiches and mayonnaise on it. And from that, I still don't need a sardine. Well, we came from, you either from broken homes or from parents that had been divided by
a death. From this home, you and your friends would give the sandwiches to these guys.
Right. But these were, I mean, they were nice men. They weren't, you would never think that they would do you bodily harm. They weren't what you would call hobos or bums. These were hard luck guys. People today, when they talk about the good old times, I think, I don't know if they mean it with sentimentality. They can't mean, these can't be good old times and that men wanted to work and couldn't work.
Yeah, this was a woman who grew up in an orphanage. They didn't know that there was anything wrong. They would see men hungry, and they would give them their food. It was kind of confusing. Unemployment was 50% in many areas. People under 21 in Detroit, unemployment is 50% easily. Generally, it's about 35% in Detroit. And businesses just kept disappearing overnight and kept putting more and more people out of work. People could not, first quarter, 1900 to 1930 or so, people still had the idea in their head that if you work hard, you can flourish and prosper and be happy. And when it didn't work that way, they figured it must have been their fault. They must have screwed up somehow. They truly believed it was either their fault or punishment from God, or they had no clue what was wrong.
You're made to feel that it's your own fault. If you're poor, it's only because you're lazy and you're ignorant and you don't try to help yourself. And you're made to feel that if you get a check from the welfare, that the bank at Fort Knox is going to go broke.
It was not a romantic time. It was a time of the most terrible suffering. And it was a time when the contradictions were so obvious that it really didn't take a very bright person to see that something was terribly wrong with it. But now, in my own case, I thought, you know, it was so insane. The idea of children shaking into pieces with rickets and the milk being poured in the gutter. That was just so ridiculous. And with this went on, this wasn't just a few people. These were thousands of people. You see, in Jefferson County, about three-fifths of the people were on relief. And there was no government relief, so this meant that they had this just these $2.50 a week that the Red Cross provided them, and what they could beg, borrow, or steal. But the thing that also struck me as being so terrible was that just the way my mother and father had this terrible feeling of shame and guilt, and it was their failure that lost all their property. These people had the same feeling of shame and guilt. They lost their jobs. They didn't blame the Republic Steel Company or the United States Steel. They didn't blame the capitalist system. They just blamed themselves. And they thought, well, you know, they would say in the most apologetic way, well, you know, if we hadn't bought that radio, if we hadn't bought that old secondhand car, if we'd saved our money. And, you know, they really blamed themselves. It was this terrible feeling they had of shame that they were on relief. And one of the things, too, that just struck me was such horror was that the fundamentalist preachers would tell them that they were suffering because they'd sinned. And they believed that too. They really felt that they had sinned and God was punishing them. And that children were dying of starvation and shaken with the rickets because of their own sins. To me, this was just perfectly horrible. I mean, the whole thing was just, and yet I didn't know the reason.
And like she was saying, they didn't know the reason. They didn't quite understand. They didn't understand economics. They didn't understand domino factors. You folks out there are lucky because you have the ability to understand how dominoes fall. Whether you face it or not is up to you. You can see how it happens and you can see what happens. And they didn't have welfare at the time at all. But they did have Red Cross. They did have a lot of churches. There were a lot of rich people who actually set up bread lines, who actually donated bread, loaves of bread. Hundreds of thousands of people got food during the Depression the only way they could, which was from handouts. People came from the farms. The farms that were pretty much failing because of the Dust Bowl, which is a whole other story. They come to the city for to find jobs and to provide for their family. So next thing you have is them standing in line. It was a foreign thing. It was not something that they'd ever thought about in their whole lives.
When were you aware of the Depression?
I believe when I first started noticing the difference was when we'd come home from school in the evening. My mother had sent us to the soup line. We were never allowed to cuss. But after we'd been going on that soup to the soup line for about a month, we'd go down there, and if you happened to be one of the first ones in line, you didn't get anything but water that was on top. So we'd ask the guy that was ladling out the soup into the buckets. Everybody had to bring their own bucket to get the soup. And he'd dip the greasy, watery stuff off the top. And so we'd ask him to please dip down so we could get some meat and potatoes from the bottom of the kettle. And he wouldn't do it. So then we learned to cuss, and we'd say, "Dip down, goddammit." And then we'd go across the street, and one place had bread, large loaves of bread, and then down the road just a little piece was a big shed, and they gave milk. And my sister and me would take two buckets each, and we'd bring one back full of soup and one back full of milk and two loaves of bread each. And that's what we lived on for the longest time. And I can remember one time we didn't have anything to eat, and I don't know if this was before the soup line. I remember the only thing in the house to eat was mustard. And my sister and me put so much mustard on biscuits that we got sick, and we can't stand mustard right today.
When I was a kid, they didn't have welfare, they didn't have food stamps, but they did have, at that time, the federal government had stores of food that they had stocked up throughout the United States in case of this kind of problem again. They were quite proud, the federal government was quite proud, that they had at least 7 days of food stored up for every citizen in the United States. This is before the Democrats realized if they allowed illegals in, they could buy new voters. So you have millions and millions of illegals in that aren't really citizens. But that food, they'd cycle it. You know, you'd rotate your food. You buy a bunch of food and you'd use it a little bit. And this is if you're at home, you know, you stock up food and then you draw from that stuff you bought longest time ago and you put the fresh stuff in the back. The government do the same thing. They would hand out the older foods to the poor. They'd talk to all the churches and say, on December 1st, we're going to have a food handout down at in Oakland. We'd all show up, and everybody was given a box with stuff in it. And we would get, like, powdered milk, pancake mix, a gallon tub of peanut butter, the equivalent of a five-gallon bucket of cornflakes, Velveeta cheese, all kinds of different stuff. This last interview, he was talking about having just biscuits and mustard. Well, 1 month, all we had was cornflakes and peanut butter. You know, you can do a lot with cornflakes and peanut butter. Grandma taught us how to make peanut butter balls and wrapped them in wax paper. And just all kind. Well, we had food, and it was as simple as that. And during the Depression, people didn't have money to buy all the commodities that the farmers were putting out, the milk and the beef, the pork, the eggs, corn. They just didn't have the money to buy it. And the government, being insane, come up with this brilliant idea that, well, people aren't buying it because the stuff's too cheap, because there's too much of it out there. So what we're going to do is we're going to make the farmers kill off most of their dairy herds, kill off most of their hog on their hog ranches and farms, and plow under their corn. And because you know how the law of supply and demand works, when the supply is low, demand's high, prices should go back up high. Government being insane, all government up to this very day had no clue what the hell they were doing. So here's starving people throughout the United States. The government's so disassociated with these people that they had no idea what the hell they were doing. All they were looking at was the dollar bill. And thousands of people are starving. He's a Wall Street investment agent. This guy survived through it because he worked for some of the larger investment corporations, companies in New York City. And he was interviewed.
The thing that comes into my mind, Suggs, is the sight of the line up and down the length of Times Square every day, lining up for coffee and donuts that were being dealt out from great trucks. And there would be a line of men stretched for two and three blocks that went on for hours. You see these men silent, shuffling along the line with their, for the most part, shabby clothes, but clothes that you could see were many of them once pretty good clothes and getting the stand up. Their faces, I'd stand and look at their faces, and I'd see that kind of flat, opaque specialist look, which spelled for me human disaster. On every corner, there would be men selling apples. Every corner.
So he was talking about the men were thousands and thousands of them, and they would come to Wall Street to try and get work, and they would stand in lines. They didn't have food, but some of the larger bakeries would fill trucks full of donuts. These donuts aren't like the ones we go buy a dozen of them for $3.99 now with all kinds of sprinkles on them and chocolate syrup. This was just plain cake donuts and coffee. You know, they'd have like four or five of those donuts and a couple cups of coffee, and that's what they'd eat all day while they were waiting, trying to find work. Do you ever read The Grapes of Wrath? If you have not read The Grapes of Wrath, that is a must-have book. That is a rear-view mirror that should be read by every citizen in the United States at least twice. Once when you're young and the other time when you're older. Because it talks about people saying, you know, there's nothing here. I'm going to have to hit the road. And that's what thousands of people did. They took to the road. They followed the harvest, one harvest to another. They picked fruit or vegetables. They walked, hitchhiked. They drove covered wagons. They rode in jalopies. They just moved about.
Well, how'd you and your husband get around? What means a transport?
We hitchhiked. I was pregnant when we first started hitchhiking. People were really very nice to us. Sometimes they would feed us. And then I remember the one time we slept in a haystack and the lady of the house came out and found us. And she says, well, this is really very bad for you because you're going to have a baby. And she says, you need a lot of milk. So she took us up to the house and she had a lot of rugs hanging on the clothesline because she was doing her house cleaning. And we told her we'd beat the rugs, you know, for her giving us the food. And she said, no, she didn't expect that she just wanted to feed us, and we said no, that we couldn't take it unless we worked for it. So she let us beat her rugs, and I think she had a million rugs, and we cleaned them, and then we went in, and she had a beautiful table just all full of all kind of food and milk. And then when we left, she filled a gallon bucket full of milk, and we took it with us. You don't find that now. I think maybe if you did that now, you'd get arrested. I think somebody'd call the police.
And actually, there's stories that come out in the past month of people being arrested, being charged because of helping other people by giving them food. See, they didn't have politically correct words like street people or hobo's a hobo. And these guys knew it. And they traveled around. And I remember as a kid, we lived right on the railroad tracks in Eureka, California for a short period. And right down about a couple hundred yards from the house on the other side of the tracks was a hobo camp. This is where I learned about the term hobo stew. They had a 5-gallon paint bucket that somebody had cleaned out really well and had on a tripod above us all. Always burning fire, and everybody that could would come by and toss something else in there, either a rabbit or a can of corn or a couple of chopped up taters or what have you. And there was always 5-gallon bucket of bubbling food. You never knew what you were going to dip into there, but I used to talk to these hobos. In fact, one of them saved my life one time. I was walking along the railroad tracks, and there was some quicksand there between the ties, and I jumped right between the ties, and I went straight down like a wet bag of Schumer, and I yelled, and one of these hobos heard it and come running up, and I was right at my neck. And he reached down, grabbed me, and pulled me up and took me home. And I got my butt tanned for doing that. I wasn't supposed to be down at the hobo camp, but they'd always talk about how, I'd hear them, they'd talk about how, yeah, well, I know where work is. There's work headed south of here. There's plenty of work. There's work in the vineyards north of here, up in the Klamath. Or there's work over here. Oh, hell, you know what? I'm heading down to Sutter's Mill. I understand they still got gold down there, and I'm just going to go down there and strike it rich, or I'm going into Sacramento, and I'm going to ride the rail here all the way down into Sacramento. And they're always talking about finding a special place where they don't have to bust their butts, where they don't have to keep traveling, where they don't have to worry about where their next meal is going to come from.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountain. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks,
and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats and the railroad pulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Yeah, they talked about that. Now, when I was young, it was a couple decades after the Great Depression or so, and they still talked about that. They still talked about finding the mother lode, finding a place where they could settle down and be happy. But these guys didn't. Hobos don't want to settle down. They like to travel. But people in all throughout the United States, they were losing their homes, their farms, kind of like exactly what's happening now. And the banks then and the government then, as now, they had no concern for the people. They really flat don't care. It's only money. If you were a week late on your mortgage payment, they'd start for foreclosure actions. I remember about a year ago reading about this judge in Florida who was bragging how he could do a foreclosure one every 30 seconds. During the Depression, these arrogant and elitist judges became famous. They'd issue over 400 judgments a day. And then they'd go home at night to their mansions, servants, and good food. And they had farm auctions. It was common sight. Sometimes what would happen is the friends of the farmers get together and they'd all agree that we're going to bid pennies on this for John's. And then at the end of the auction, we'll just give him back everything. Well, the bank auctioneers, if there was a bid and a second bid above that, by law, they had to take that second bid. So somebody bid a penny on this guy's house. And the second guy would say, I bid 2 cents. And they did that a lot. Guys ended up getting their farms back. They just pay him back for everything. I've had people say, what do you mean losing their farms? How can they lose their farm if it's been in their family for 100 years? Well, what happens is, it was hard making a living off of farming. So when you're ready to plant, you would go to the bank and you'd get a loan against your farm for seed, repairs on your farming implements, maybe a horse or something, you know. You'd get a loan for the new season, knowing or hoping that, you know, once everything was harvested and you sold everything, you could pay back the loan easily and still have profit. That was standard. Credit was a destroyer. And that's what happened. Is these farmers, they kept getting more and more credit. And then there were droughts. So they lost their butts. These farms that have been in the families for hundreds of years were auctioned off. Large corporations. Kind of like what's happening now. We're literally paying pennies on the dollar. Let's say you owed $20,000 and you had a 100-acre farm with a nice house and a barn and cattle and pigs and chicken. And well, if you owed $20,000 and all that people had cash was maybe $1,000, well, that whoever bought it, they have everything, lock, stock, and barrel for $1,000, and then the government come after you, or the banks would come after you for the balance. They would take everything you owned, literally, to satisfy those debts. After a while, those farmers got a little uppity. They got a little upset at this because the banks didn't want to listen to reason. Didn't want to listen to anyone saying, you know what, give us a chance, please. Government didn't want to listen. They could care less because the government is controlled by the banks, which are controlled by the corporations.
When I say to you, Mr. Helene, the Great American Depression, what thought comes to your mind or memory?
I suppose if you want to go back to the real struggle of the individuals when, after he'd lived all his life on a given farm, he lost it. It was taken away from him, just one after the other. We didn't have very many laws that protected the individual as we have today. For instance, you had a foreclosure, and the mortgage was rather substantial, but after the foreclosure, there wasn't enough value in the farm to cover the face of the mortgage, so they got a deficiency judgment against the individual, and he couldn't pay. So not only did he lose the farm, but he had a judgment placed upon him that would almost make it impossible for him to ever get out of debt. The judge in Plymouth County Court had a habit of very quickly and easily giving a deficiency judgment. Not only that, but he would issue foreclosure papers and would have closing out sales of the farmers. And it got so that the farmers couldn't stand it anymore. They'd see their neighbors sold out. There were no purchasers to speak of because there wasn't any money. So the little that the farm sale would produce wouldn't pay the bills. First they'd take the farm and then they took your working material, your livestock and farm machinery and even the household goods. Everything was mortgaged and they'd move you off. So these farmers that gathered this particular day came down from Primgar and drove through Marcus, stopped up here at the community oil station, and I suppose some of them probably decided that they ought to have a little drink on the side, and so they developed a little courage. They decided that we'll go down and we'll teach that judge a lesson that's holding court and issuing these deficiency judgments and putting people off of the land. They marched into the courtroom, hats on, demanded to see the judge and to visit with him, and he decided that he would teach them a lesson, and so he says, "Gentlemen, this is my court. I want you to remove your hats and address the court properly." They just laughed at him. And he says, "We came in here to get redress from your actions. We're not concerned about whose court this is, except that it is doing the things that we can't stand to have done to us anymore." And so this argument kept on until they got rougher and rougher, and they finally went up and drug him from his chair, pulled him down the steps of the courthouse, shook a rope in front of his face, and then tarred and feathered him. The governor called out the National Guard and put some of these farmers behind barbed wire. Now you just imagine the National Guard putting a whole group of farmers behind barbed wire in this state. You don't forget these things.
The farmers met in Lamar's and marched up to the courthouse where Judge Bradley was sitting on the bench, just sitting in court. The farmers objected to the losing their farm.
Foreclosures.
Yeah. I think the farmers were right. They had a just cause because, for instance, they'd have a mortgage on their farm, say a 15, 20, 25, whatever it was on their farm. They would foreclose it and lose that entire farm.
The farm is worth probably 70 or 80,000, and they'd foreclose that and take the whole works on a $15,000 or $20,000 mortgage. That wasn't fair. And I don't blame them for taking the stand that they did.
They took the judge off of his seat and put a rope around him.
They were going to hang him.
They were going to hang him, yeah. They took him out.
He was frightened. He was scared to death.
Did they tar and feather him?
No.
They tarred and feathered, I think.
Not here.
But not here.
But they had the rope around his neck. Mm-hmm. And he was pretty well frightened.
He was scared to death because he couldn't do anything. There wasn't anything he could do. All he could do was carry out
the law,
whatever the law was.
It really ruined his life. He never was the right after that.
No. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He was, well, I think he retired. He was not well at all. I think the effects of that.
Mm. Oh,
that's quite a shock to an older man.
When you're within an inch of having your life take him out.
A mob. A group of farmers, you know, there were hundreds of them, I guess, and he was at their mercy, and I don't know how they finally decided not to do it.
See, during a depression, people had a little gumption, but that's been bred out pretty much and drugged out because the powers that be just flat don't want us getting pissed off or getting uppity when their corporate agents take our property, steal from us. They got many different words they use for it now. They call it asset forfeiture. They call it foreclosure. There's a lot of people out there. I have a lot of listeners who argue with me on this point, and they say, no, when the Schumer hits the fan and the government orders, as they will, when the government orders the National Guard or the military to come in and do things, well, they're not going to, because that'd be anti-constitutional. But if you just listen to what I said, they call the National Guard in. They do what they're told. If I wanted to do a couple hours of research, I could find 50 times when the military or law enforcement in the United States violated constitutional restrictions and common morality in dealing with the citizens of the United States. Don't ever think the military or law enforcement are your friends. They're not your friends. They're not your allies. They have a job to do. It's as simple as that. And they'll do it. Don't don't ever doubt it. Prior to that time, everyone was convinced that the bank was the best place to put your money. Put your money in the banks. It's safe in the banks. Why? Why is it safe in the banks? Because the banks are big, made out of concrete and steel. Makes them safe, don't you know? And the banks started falling like dominoes. And literally, and this is not exaggeration, my grandpa was telling me of a bank in Placerville, that folks would go there and cash their paychecks, and the bank would say, you know, you got this paycheck here for $50. Now, how much can you, do you need all 50 of it? How about just $10 of it? And people say, okay, just deposit most of it. And that's what they did. They deposited most of their checks and then took a little bit out. And grandpa had his check. He had a $25 check. He sold a car for $25. He went to the bank and they said, well, do you need all of it? And this was standard procedure. He said, hell yeah, I need all of it. I'm going gambling. So they gave him all of it. And Monday morning, the bank was empty. When I say empty, I mean the door was wide open. All the desks were gone. The vault was empty. Everything was empty. The bank, the sign up top was gone. Everything was gone. The bank had closed over the weekend. Anybody who had money in that bank lost it. You had no recourse whatsoever. Now, first, the bank started restricting the amount you could withdraw, kind of like what they're doing now. And a lot of you out there know exactly what I'm talking about. The banks are restricting how much money you can withdraw. There are some banks that are charging you a percentage for your withdrawals, and they're doing that because they don't want you taking all the money out because they don't have money. Most of the banks now, in fact, all of the banks in the United States do not have the money to cover the deposits that have been deposited because they've invested that money. So as an example, let's say a bank opens up on a corner and people deposit up to about $1 million. Logic denotes there's still that $1 million is sitting there in the bank. No, there might be $20,000, $30,000 cash sitting in that bank. The rest of it's been loaned out or invested. What happens is these banks started shutting their doors. That was it. You lost all your money. The corporate government here in the United States come out with this Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that claims that your money is covered up to $250,000 deposit. Well, the FDIC is flat broke. They end up buying banks back anywhere from $50 to $500 million a week. Every Friday night, the FDIC posts what banks that went belly up. And if you do a little bit of research, you realize they're out of money. Where the hell is the money coming from? The money's coming from the Federal Reserve being a private corporation, and in direct violation of the Constitution, just prints up more money, hands it to the Federal Reserve, says, here, use this. Oh, by the way, let me have those mortgages just as collateral, because I know you're going to pay us back, right? At the end of the Depression, over 9,000 banks had gone out of business. Now, there's a difference between the banks then and banks now. Banks then, there was a bank on every corner. I mean, a bank, not a branch, a bank on every corner. Now, you have branches on every corner, like Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo has like 23,000 branches, and most banks do. Most banks have more than one branch. So when you hear about a bank closing, that's not just one branch they're talking about. You'd have the name, like Citizens Trust of East Texas. Well, Citizens Trust has 15 branches all throughout Texas. So when the news comes out Citizens Trust closes, that's 15 different branches that just closed. And for now, the government is covering any deposits. But I wouldn't trust that, especially anything that has to do with a safety deposit box. Safety deposit box, people use the term safety, thinking, oh, yeah, that means it's safe. My money, my stuff, whatever I put in that box is safe. Well, right now, British police are seizing safety deposit boxes. Right now in England, like I said, they're seizing safety deposit boxes in certain areas. And I have people who have talked to me who have had their safety deposit box seized here in the United States. My uncle was one of the vice presidents of Crocker Bank before it was bought by Wells Fargo years ago. And his job was to go bank to bank and inventory abandoned safety deposit boxes. If nobody's been there nobody's checked into it or paid for their box over a year or 2 years, I don't remember exactly what it was to go and inventory what's in that box for probate purposes in case the person had died. And I used to go to him. I'm a kid. I used to go with him. We would find piles of gold, piles of cash, guns, knives, jewelry, all kinds of stuff. And I asked him, well, why are we going in these boxes if they're safe boxes? Don't they belong to someone? Well, we don't know if they do or not. But what we're going to do is we're going to inventory it, take it all, put it in a box, and put it into a giant vault downtown San Francisco, down in the basement. So if this person ever shows up, or if their survivors show up, say, hey, Fred Lipschitz was my uncle, and I got the rights to a safety deposit box. And if they can prove it, then we'll go get it and give it to him. I said, Uncle Ray, what happens if nobody comes by? He goes, well, there's a few more years goes by, and then the government gets it. The government gets it. Well, who do you think owns the banks? Who do you think controls all this? And during the Depression, there was a hell of a lot of disparity, because it wasn't everybody starving. It wasn't everybody poor. And just like now, there were only specific areas that were hit massively. There were some people who actually had jobs and could make it work, but there were always the elitists. Then, as now, the government was run by the elitists.
There's one thing that started me thinking. It was President Roosevelt's cufflinks. I read in the paper about how many pairs of cufflinks he had, and it told that some of them were rubies and all precious stones. These were his cufflinks. And I just wondered, I'll never forget, I was sitting on an old tire out in the front yard, and we were hungry and so poor. And I was sitting out there in the hot sun, there weren't any trees. And I was wondering why it was that one man could have all those cufflinks when we couldn't even have enough to eat.
Right now, we have an abomination in the White House, as they did then, who is basically going on vacations right and left. Right now, he's paying $50,000. He's going on vacation, paying $58,000 a week for the vacation that he's going on. And his wife and kids go on these million-dollar junkets right and left. The abomination goes out there and plays golf quite a bit. Nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But while he's out there living it up, of course, he's the elitist and he knows what's right and wrong and what should be done and what shouldn't be done, because that's his job. He's the Messiah, so he knows everything. And it just, us stupid people just can't quite get a grasp on what he wants done. And it's our own damn fault that we can't make it work. And even during the Depression, it just didn't work. There was people lose their homes, lose their farms, lose everything, and they'd end up finding a place, throwing up some tin or some cardboard or some tar paper or a tent, and they called these places Hoovervilles. Hooverville was a popular name for shanty towns built by homeless people during the Depression. They were named after the President of the United States at the time, Herbert Hoover, because he had allegedly let the nation slide into Depression. Hoover was, I don't know, it had been said that Hoover was more feminine than he was masculine, and he just sort of let everybody do what the hell they wanted, and he did nothing right in any way, shape, or form. And the Hooverville was describing all these tent cities that were common during the Depression.
My dad said to us kids, all of you get in the car. I want to take you and show you something. And on the way over there, he talked about how rough life had been for us. And he said, if you think it's been rough for us, he said, I want you to see people that really had it rough. And he took us over, this was in Oklahoma City, and he took us to one of the Hoovervilles. And that was the most incredible thing. Here were all these people living in old, rusted out car bodies. I mean, that was their home. There were people living in shacks made out of orange crates. One family with a whole lot of kids were living in a piano box. And here, this wasn't just a little section. This was an area maybe 10 miles wide and 10 miles long. People living in whatever they could jam together.
Now, I remember as a kid seeing actual video that had been taken. I was down in Hollywood, and I was looking some recordings that had been done. This was in the outskirts of Beverly Hills. They didn't advertise this, and they didn't brag about it, but there were some tent cities, some Hoovervilles there, where literally people had moved into some vacant areas. One guy had dug an 8-foot hole that was about 10 feet wide by 20 feet long and 8 feet deep, and he had a ladder going down in it. Nothing covering it. He was working on getting some tar paper or something to cover it, but him and his family moved into this hole. This is where they were living. And other people would throw a tent over their car. See, nowadays, people say, oh, that's just camping. But this is where the people lived. They had nowhere else to live. These weren't street people, quote unquote. These were homeless. These were real homeless. Not somebody who said, you know, I hate you. I'm going to go run away and live on the street. These are people who don't have an option. I have customers that come in my store that lived for 2 years in his car. And now he's trying to make it go right. And I have women who have lived in their vans or who have lived in the campers. If any of you remember the woman, Angie Dickinson, we met her some years back, and she was living a Class B motorhome, which is like a big van, with her loudmouth parrot. And she was making enough money to survive on, but that was about it. I don't know what the whole story was on that, but that's what people did. They had to. Can't just give up and say the hell with it and shoot themselves. Talking about the Hoovervilles. Now, yeah, that was then, right? That's that kind of thing. That would never happen here, would it? We'd never have any, like, Obamavilles, would we?
The situation here at home for so many people is becoming more and more dire. In the capital city of the state of California, a tent city has gone up for those who have run out of options. It's grown in size and quickly. Our report tonight from NBC's Chris Jansing.
Along the railroad tracks in Sacramento, a modern-day shantytown is swelling, fragile shelter for the city's exploding homeless population. The images, hauntingly reminiscent of the iconic photos of the 1930s and the Great Depression. With unemployment rising, there are now at least 2,100 homeless in Sacramento. About 300 live here, with more arriving every day.
Many of the stories here are heartbreakingly similar. Middle-class Americans living paycheck to paycheck lose their job, then their house, and have nowhere to go. Every shelter in Sacramento is filled to overflowing.
It's happening in Seattle, too, tent cities in Reno and Nashville. Sudden homelessness brought on by unexpected, shocking poverty. The new mayor, former NBA star Kevin Johnson, grew up in Sacramento.
This has been a dirty little secret, and we've kind of swept it under the rug.
The evocative Depression-era images return. At dusk, dinner is simmering in a pot made out of a coffee can. Advocates say that by morning, as many as 50 more people will be homeless in Sacramento.
If you haven't seen this story yet this morning, you need to stop what you're doing and take a look. The images will stun you. Up to 50 people are reportedly showing up to the tent city each week. Many of them have lost their jobs and consequently their homes. Very sad and an upsetting state of this country's affairs.
A century and a half ago, this area around Sacramento was basically the center of the gold rush. Prospectors pitching their tents along the banks of the American River in order to strike it rich. And today what we see is regular Americans pitching their tents sometimes in the shadows of downtown Sacramento's skyscrapers in the hopes of basically buying more time or simply because they just don't have any other choice. The shelters in and around the town are absolutely overflowing with people. We understand from authorities that there's some 1,500 or so people living in these tent cities, and as you mentioned, with 50 newcomers joining them essentially every single week.
Now, I've been to these tent cities in Sacramento. I know the areas. I have physically seen these cities, as they call them. Well, there's hundreds of them. There's hundreds of people in these areas, each one. And there's more than just one or two in the Sacramento area. There's some downtown. There's some off the railroad tracks. People that went through the Depression, they didn't talk about this, but there were thousands and thousands that committed suicide. And the ones that went through it were scarred, both emotionally and physically. I've met people who survived it and ended up kind of screwed up in the mind. And they would do things like they didn't believe in buying toilet paper because it was something you throw away, so they had special handkerchiefs that they'd wipe their butt with. Just like a diaper, you know, you change your diaper for your baby. And then they would save these in basket, and then once every day they'd take them and they'd hand wash them. But there's nothing like the degradation of being reduced to a nothing. A worthless lump of hungry flesh that survives with the grace of others. A non-productive member of society. A worthless eater.
Almost startling to me that the generation that lived and grew up during the Depression would not tell their children about it or describe it to them in detail simply because they were ashamed of it. I think this certainly surprises me. I never thought that the people themselves would be ashamed of it. I imagine it's certainly nothing to be ashamed of. If anyone was going to feel like it was their fault or something, I suppose it might be people in government who realized, look, there's inflation or there's deflation or, you know, this margin buying and spending is not going to work, and they're the ones that missed the boat, and I imagine they're the ones that should have, if anyone was going to, you know, jumped off that building. But certainly I don't think that the people that grew up or were factory workers or white collar men or blue collar men or men that didn't wear any collars at all should feel any shame at all about it. It was something that happened in the American economy, and it by its happening, it gave us a chance to realize exactly what caused it, and we are hopeful that it won't happen again.
Yeah, we're hopeful that it won't happen again, but the problem is those that don't learn from history are bound to repeat it. And that's exactly what's occurring in the United States right now. There are people much more learned than I who have gone back through history and said, the same exact thing happened 350 years ago, same exact thing happened 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, and on and on and on and on. And it just keeps happening and and the people who went through the Depression, both the people like my grandparents who went through it and their children. And this is where socialism gets its toehold here in the United States. When you have those of such richness on one side and people who are so poor that they can't even, the old saying goes, they don't have two nickels to rub together, that is a disparity of values, and it's astounding. Now, during the Depression, it wasn't as if people sat on their butts at home, got food stamps, welfare, became obese and popped out children like they're making a Jiffy Pop popcorn. It didn't happen that way. The people then were astounded and in shock, and it's like, what do you mean I don't have a job? What do you mean I can't get a job? That's impossible. What the hell is that? This country? This country is so great. How could I not have a job? People became justifiably angry at the rich.
Children shouldn't have to go around stealing. There's enough in this country to give all of them everything they want, anytime they want it. And I say that's what we're going to have. I don't think people were put on earth to suffer. I think that's a lot of nonsense. We are the highest development on the earth, and I think we were put here to live and be happy and enjoy everything that's here. I don't think it's right for a handful of people to get a hold of all the things that make living a joy instead of a sorrow. When you wake up in the morning and the minute consciousness hits you, it's just like a big hand takes a hold of your heart and squeezes it because you don't know what that day's going to bring. I think that's the worst thing that our system does to people is to take away their pride, and it prevents them from being a human being. And they're wondering why the Harlem and why the Detroit, and they're talking about troops and law and order. And you get law and order in this country when people are allowed to be decent human beings and be able to walk in dignity.
Well, unfortunately, the way the government has propagandized it over the years, dignity and your pride is something that you're supposed to have automatically and not by earning it. When my son was younger and I ran a gun shop in Modesto, California, one of our relatives got kicked out of his house, so he shows up at our place. I told his parents that I will take him in and I will raise him and I will put the fear of me in him and he will be a success in life. And this kid shows up with I can't call them shorts. They were kind of like shorts that went down almost to his knees. He had big floppy tennis shoes that were untied. He had a real long t-shirt. His hat was sideways on his head. He had pimples in everywhere you could dream of on his face, his arms, his legs. I set him down and I'm explaining to him what he's going to be doing. He goes, "You can't talk to me like that. You can't tell me that because I got my pride." And I looked at him. Everyone around, my brother, my son, my wife, they were trying not to laugh. And I said, "You got your pride. Where'd you get that pride from? You get that pride from failing high school. You get that pride from doing drugs. You get that pride from living in the woods because you got kicked out of your house. You get that pride from the fact that you have no concept of cleanliness and your body is infected with who knows how many critters. Where do you get this pride?" But that's pretty much what they got now. You have in the United States over 50%. And I've been told it's almost 60%. All it has to be is 25% and the country's gone, and we're over 50% of people who live with their lips firmly attached to the government's tit. They couldn't survive if they didn't get something for free. They couldn't survive in any way, shape, or form if they couldn't get something from the government one way or the other. Food stamps, Medi-Cal, welfare, free daycare, free cars, free houses. This whole economic calamity we're in is not a surprise, ladies and gentlemen. Let's come up into present time now. We talked about the depression. What, do you think it's not happening now? Every single thing I talked about, you can turn around and see it somewhere. And if you can look at the way society is and put a volume control knob on it, the Great Depression, quote unquote, was probably on a scale of 1 to 10, 0 to 10 on this control knob, was probably about a 5. Right now, we're about 6.9 on this control knob. So percentage-wise, we are way worse off than they were then in that degree. America lost all kinds of farmland because of the Dust Bowl and poor farming methods. We've lost farmland now because of corporate greed, corporations buying off the farms and shutting them down. We have less farmland right now active in the United States than they had during the Depression. We're having to get most of our food imported from China, South America, and other places. This whole thing was planned with a total intent to create an entitlement society of paid, ignorant voters. There's no questions. There's no mystery. This is how it's done. You take away a person's ability to survive on his own. You take away a person's willingness to make it on his own and convince them that they're too stupid, dumb, dangerous, ignorant, or weak, and they must have help from the government to survive. And now you have America. Now, obviously, it's not 100% of us. There's people like me who I won't take a damn thing from the government because I know what it means when you make a deal with the devil. There are people out there who say, "I'll be more than happy to trade my soul because I don't believe I have one. I'll be more than happy to trade it for 4 years of college or a good job." But then there are those of us who can learn by looking and seeing exactly what happened and know what's going to happen. And by the way, our government has come up with a great idea of how to cure everything. In fact, I just saw the commercial this morning.
I was in chronic pain, and my family struggling to make ends meet, food and gas prices going up, even keeping my job was iffy. Then I learned about a new miracle drug made in Washington, D.C.
Spend It All.
Spend It All is Washington's answer to all the painful problems Americans face. How to borrow $800 billion for a stimulus that didn't create jobs or fix the economy? Spend It All.
Spend It All is not for everyone. Side effects may include a mountain of government debt piled on our kids, a sudden loss of freedoms, higher prices for everything, leaving our kids a lesser America than we had. Ask your doctor or congressman if your conscience is strong enough for Spend It All.
And it's so popular in Washington, we have to borrow, import trillions more of it from China. Spend It All makes you feel better now and pushes off the really bad stuff till later for them to deal with.
Yeah, it's kind of humorous and funny, but I'll tell you this. Murphy was real. You need, ladies and gentlemen, to plan because you're going to either be a survivor or a victim. And there could be many different things that occur in your life that cause this phenomenon to occur for you individually. It could be a flood. It could be a fire. It could be the threat of government agents or the military or law enforcement. We have in the United States right now many organizations that are reminiscent of Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong would stand in awe at what the past few presidents have accomplished within the United States because they've not been able to accomplish this kind of suppression in their own countries without murdering hundreds of thousands of people. And yet here in the United States, we just bend over and say, well, just don't make it hurt too much. Just like I've always said, you need to plan ahead. You need to put money aside if you can. When I was a kid, I was told, take 10%. Now, my minister at the church said, you take 10% of whatever you earn and you put it aside. And I said, don't you mean you give it to you? And he goes, what, are you out of your mind? No, you give us what you can. But you need to take 10% of whatever you earn. If you earn a dollar, you take 10 cents and you put it in your piggy bank. If you earn $10, you take a dollar of that and you put it in your piggy bank. And you don't touch that until times of dire need. And I took that to heart, ladies and gentlemen. I really did. And over the years, I've done that. And my wife, who I've known now for about 30 years, give or take a millennium, she thought I was kind of nuts when I explained this to her. But she thanks me for it now, because now we have the ability to survive. Because I put aside money. I put aside food. I put aside everything that you would need in case the stores closed, the trucks stopped coming, people started getting hungry, people started getting scared. And they will. There's not even a question about this. This is what happens. And the corporate representatives, our government, is doing everything in their power to throw bread and circuses at the masses. This is what the Romans did. Free bread. Never worry about being hungry, and we'll keep you amused with the circuses. So even if you don't want to get up and work, well, you can get food stamps. You can get food. Somehow, there's always some place giving away free food. You know something interesting I discovered about life? Life is a participation sport. You can't run it on the sidelines. You've got to get right in, roll your sleeves up, and get down and dirty. And then you have to persist at it. In your 20s and 30s, and even in some of us into the 40s, it's having a good time going out on the weekends to the lake, to the river, floating around in rafts, getting drunk, going playing games, enjoying life, not participating, just being there. And then there are those of us who actually paid attention, who actually learned from history. So I want all of you to do the same thing. My job is to help you. My job is to get you off your butt, piss you off sometimes, make you think sometimes, and try and impress upon you the importance of thinking ahead. That concept of thinking ahead is foreign to most people. They go, what the hell does that mean? That means Murphy was a real person, and Murphy's Law works. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. Always expect the best, but plan for the worst. And that's why I have my company, and that's why I have my radio show. The last part of this show is a song that I play at the end of every one of my shows. The writer is going to explain the song, and I want you to listen to it. I appreciate y'all listening, and I hope I helped. You go to SE1.us. You can call us, Survival Enterprises, 800-753-1981. That's 800-753-1981. 7 days a week, we are here to help you.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread?
We thought American business, American economics, was the Rock of Gibraltar, that we were the prosperous nation in the world, that nothing could stop us now, that a brownstone house was forever, that you gave it to your kids and that they put marble fronts on it. And there was a feeling of continuity. There was a feeling of, if you made it, it was there forever. And suddenly the big dream exploded like a bubble. So this crash came, where this beautiful fantasy business of ours was over, and I was walking along the street at that time, as you always do, seeing the bird lines.
Well, that Brother Can You Spare a Dime finally hit you on every block and every street, and I thought that would be a wonderful title if I could only work it out by telling people, by through the song, that it isn't just a man asking for a dime, saying I'm hard luck. This is a man who says, I built the railroads. I built that tower. I fought your war. I was the kid with the drum. I was the guy in khaki. Why the hell should I be standing in line now? Why? What happened to all this wealth that I've created? And I think that's what made the song live.
Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?